So, I want to continue on a topic that I've been talking about now for about a week in various places. And it's a topic which maybe some people like to hear about, and some people immediately would rather not hear about it. And to be patient. And so the topic is of bowing. And I brought it up about a week ago, and then last Monday I talked about it, and there was some interesting exchanges after the talk about it that sent me thinking about bowing quite a bit. And one of the interesting aspects of, I believe, of a spiritual life is to spend some time inquiring, reflecting deeply about different themes and topics. And there are some themes and topics which and activities in spiritual circles which are just kind of part and parcel of the culture, which we just kind of do without thinking and reflecting deeply about what we're doing and what it's all about. And so I took the opportunity this last week to reflect more deeply and try to learn more about this phenomenon of bowing, since I was stimulated by the questions last Monday. I was told that there was more email exchange in our list server around this topic than there's ever been on any topic before. Is that right? So apparently it was interesting for some people, different camps about bowing. And I'm very fond of bowing myself. One of the interesting questions in looking at this topic of bowing is, what is the connection between bowing and meditation, insight meditation? What's the connection with the Buddha's path of liberation? We all have this phenomenal potential of living a life that's at peace without conflict, inner or outer conflict, phenomenal potential of being in the world with love and compassion and liberation. And what is the connection between that capacity and bowing? Is there a connection? What is your relationship to bowing, any one of you? And probably if we kind of surveyed the room here, we'd get quite a range of attitude towards bowing. And that's fine. I think that bowing has been, as far as I can tell, has been somewhat controversial, probably much of the time that humans have been doing bowing. There's records of the Greeks complaining about the Persians back in ancient times, because the Persians would bow to their king, and the Greeks never bowed to any human being. They only bowed to the gods. And then when Alexander the Great came along, he insisted people had to bow to him. And that was quite upsetting, because you only bow to gods. There were only people worthy of bowing to, and you wouldn't bow to a human being. And so what is this about? So even, you know, over 2,000 years ago, the Greeks were struggling around this issue of bowing. Who do you bow to? And when Buddhism went to China, it was very controversial, because one of the rules of traditional rules of Buddhist monks coming from India is that Buddhist monks don't bow to lay people, including kings, and so including the emperor of China. And this was, you know, Chinese culture was built in kind of hierarchical model, with the emperor being the son of heaven, being kind of the top of the human pyramid, in a sense kind of mediating the world between humans and gods. And and if you don't, the whole harmony of the cosmos is dependent on the harmonious relationships in this hierarchy. Children to parents, parents to, I don't know what it is, local lords, and, you know, going up to the emperor on top. And then these Buddhist monks showed up on the scene in China, and they refused to bow to the emperor. And this was outrageous. And how are they going to deal with this? And then you come, someone told us last Monday night, the story of the founding of the United States. And when they instituted the institution of presidency, the question was, do we bow to the president as people bow to the king and queen of England, bow or curtsy? And it was decided, apparently, that no, we would not bow to the president of the United States, because in the United States, everybody's equal. And bowing is a sign of inequality, at least for the colonialists, people back in those times thought. And so they weren't going to express that inequality, but they wanted to find some way to express equality. And one of the ways to do that is to shake hands, both people equal in a sense. Unless one person wants to show more superiority and they squeeze your hand harder. So, and then you have a lot of people coming out of the Jewish faith, where the idea of bowing to any kind of icon or idol or god was very much against the grain of the religion. And so Jews, who make a very big percentage of the Buddhist population in America, will have a lot of trouble with this idea of bowing, you know, bowing to the Buddha or bowing to an image. But it's not just Jews. Certain Protestants also have trouble with bowing. The Quakers, my understanding, that's like against their religion to bow, because everyone's equal. Every individual shares in the divine light. Kind of a certain Protestant, early Baptist kind of view that each individual person is sacred. Individual consciousness, individual choice is sacred in each person. You want to respect each person. You want to see the divinity in each person. And so you don't bow down to someone because that's elevating them and lowering yourself in that model of bowing, which then is not appropriate. You find the idea of subservience as an aspect of bowing in different religions, certainly. And perhaps it's just human nature that if you want to show subservience to someone, you bow down, you get down on your knees, you get lower than them. The story I've sometimes told of when I was about 20, this friend of mine was going to—he was going to duke it out with me. He was really angry with me, and he was going to fight. And he was walking across this field where I was working in the field, and it was obvious to me that he was about to. And he was bigger and stronger than me. And the only thing I could, kind of spontaneously, without even thinking about it, I dropped down on my knees, or at least I think on one knee. I dropped down on one knee and put out my hands like this. I don't remember bowing down to him, but I just, like this, you know. And like I, you know, basically saying without words, with gesture, which in some ways more powerful, I'm not going to fight. And I'm helpless. I'm not going to defend myself. Do what you wish. And here I am. And it was probably the only thing that saved me. And he just turned away in disgust and walked away. And so, you know, it's and you find very explicitly, I think, in Islam, the idea that, you know, you bow down to Allah, you bow down all the way, as I think some notions in some areas of Islam is you're slave to God. You bow down clearly in submission to that which is higher. And that's certainly been part of the notion of bowing in many different cultures. The idea of, you know, showing that that the person you're bowing to is more respect-worthy than you, or higher status than you, or in some ways you're being more subservient to that person. So that's kind of notion of bowing then, as people have reacted to, as I've talked about already. It's interesting that the Buddha didn't bow to anybody after he was enlightened. So why is it the Buddha didn't bow to anyone? Was he so arrogant, so full of himself, that he felt like he was so special and no one else was worthy of bowing to? The Buddha also doesn't bow to gods. There were a lot of pantheon of gods in ancient India. And the gods would bow to the Buddha, but he would never bow to the gods. There was nothing in the universe that was for whom the Buddha would bow to, except it said the Buddha would bow to the Dharma. Since there was no human being, no god, that was of a higher status than him, and more realized, more liberated than him. And certainly Indian culture is another one of these cultures which is hierarchical in nature. And so you have in India, higher and lower status people. And the people of lower status will bow to the people of higher status. People of higher status will generally not bow back. So a wife is lower status traditionally in India, would bow to her husband, but the husband wouldn't bow back. A student would bow to the teacher wouldn't bow back. A lay person would bow to a monastic, but the monastic or spiritual teacher wouldn't bow back. And so it goes, you know, all the different categories. And you have to can be quite complicated to keep to track, you know, where you are in relationship to all these people and know whether you're supposed to bow or not. What often the person of higher status does in receiving that bow, they put their hands together in what's called in Sanskrit anjali, or gassho in Japanese. You put your hands together like this, but you don't bow. You might bow just ever so slightly, But it's not a bow of subservience. It's just you bow like this. And then you get in Japanese culture where there's a lot of bowing. Japanese culture also is somewhat hierarchical in nature. And there they have very complicated degrees of bowing, which you have to figure out if you're in the culture. You bow at 10 degrees, 20 degrees, 30 degrees, 45 degrees, 90 degrees. All depends on the status of the person you're bowing to. And then you have to kind of figure out, do you bow 30 degrees and they bow 20 degrees. And if they've bowed 30 degrees, then you have to bow 40 degrees. If they do 40 degrees, you have to do 50 degrees, You have to kind of tune in to what's going on because you have to, the social status, the social relationships are being established in that bowing. Interesting, I learned this week, when I was in Japan, I hadn't registered to me, but the Japanese person told me this. I think it's true. I don't know if any Japanese person here knows. But there's a lot of bowing in Japanese culture. But the bowing is done with the hands on the side of their body. So like this. And the woman told me, you only bow with your hands together when you go to a Buddhist temple or a kami shrine. And then you put your hands together. You're bowing to the ancestors, you're bowing to the Buddha. And so it's much more of a kind of a spiritual activity. You go like this. Whereas out in normal society, you don't put your hands together and bow, but you just kind of bow like this. Which is kind of like the European way of bowing. I grew up in Europe a little bit. And it was quite common for me as a kid to bow. It just was part of the culture. No one ever told me to do it. I just kind of... it's something I picked up not in Norway where I grew up, but when I grew up in Italy. Maybe Norwegians don't bow, I don't think, so much. Because, Norwegians... the notion of equality in England and in America, and democracy has often been attributed to Greece. And some people argue that actually comes from Nordic influence on English culture. And it was very strong since Viking times, emphasis on equality and democracy. The oldest parliament in the world is in Iceland. And that strand of equality comes kind of through Anglo-Saxon into America through that channel. I don't know. But when I grew up in Italy, there was a member just idea of bowing. And even clicking your heels together was kind of something. And I've been told, I kind of forget, having grown up there, I didn't notice so much, but it's been so long, but I've been told that Europeans shake hands a lot more than Americans, too. There's much more that kind of contact, meeting. So what does shaking hands mean? So bowing. And then we have the San Francisco Zen Center, which is where I practiced and learned to bow as a Buddhist, where there's a lot of bowing. Bowing over, you bow all the time. And there's a lot of bowing to each other. And it occurred to me this week that that's a continuation of the monastic practices of the temple life in Japan and the training monasteries where people bow to each other. And what's happened in the San Francisco Zen Center, because they're kind of taking the monastic training kind of model for how to bow, those Zen students took it to, that's kind of like the natural thing to do all the time. So we translated that outside the temple. Remember in Japan, they bow like this outside the temple. They don't go like this. And unless maybe it's priests or monks meeting, they would do it to each other. But we have all these lay people at San Francisco Zen Center practicing. And now they leave Zen Center, living their lay lives outside of Zen Center, and they bow to each other like this. They're quite happy to do it. But it hasn't occurred to us that actually this is unusual in Japan. This is something you only do in the temple. So here you have the spreading of this bowing, putting your hands together and bowing. Spreading from a monastic situation out into society, at least Zen Center students and often Americans and stuff. And many of you, I noticed, have picked up the habit or the custom or whatever of bowing at the end of a sitting. I mostly do it these days. For a long time, I didn't. I didn't want to give the idea of sitting in the seat. I didn't want to give the idea to people who came here that you had to do what I did. So if I didn't do it, then, but lately, I like doing it. But I think that's primarily comes from the Zen world that we do that. I don't know. I didn't notice in Southeast Asia that people who actually end of a sitting would bow. They maybe get up from the sitting and bow to the altar before they left the shrine room. But the idea of bowing at the end like this, I think, something we've learned from the Zen tradition. So there's this kind of, there's all these different ideas about bowing, different cultural ideas, different religious ideas, different traditions. Are kind of seeping into our relationship to bowing. And And depending on our particular relationship, then we have our own ideas and attitude towards bowing. I like to think of bowing as a gesture. And as a gesture, it can express many different things. And so we can ask ourselves, you know, what are we expressing? What do we want to express, if anything, when we put our hands together and bow down like this? Or some people bow further. They bow all the way down to the floor. And if you understand the reason for that, a lot of Americans probably wouldn't want to bow down to the floor. And part of the reason is this idea of really putting yourself lower than the feet of the person you're bowing to, or the Buddha, for example, putting yourself lower than the feet. Sometimes in India, they would touch the feet of the guru or the whoever is higher status than you. And in Zen, when they bow to the floor, this thing about being lower than the feet is quite explicit because you're supposed to put your hand on either side of your ears and lift up when your forehead touches the floor. And the idea that I've been told is that you're lifting the Buddha standing on your hands and you're kind of lifting the Buddha up because he's on your hands. Now, that seems to me innocent enough for us in the West. But in Indian and Thai and Southeast Asian culture, the kind of purest part of a person's body is the head. And the feet are one of the more impure parts of a person's body. And by putting your feet, your head below their feet, or at their feet, you're showing how subservient, how much lower you are in status and respectworthiness than they are. Because, you know, they're so pure that they can be higher than your feet, than your head. And isn't that amazing? So the idea of purity and impurity is a very big part of the status thing in these cultures. And so Buddhism coming out of India has these elements incorporated in it, to some degree, at least in the gestures it does. So do we want to do that? We don't have the same notions of purity and impurity. If you go to Thailand, you don't want to touch someone's head. Like we might hear, nice hairdo. You kind of go like this or something or pat them. Because the head is the highest, purest part of a person's body. It's tremendously disrespectful to just touch their head, you know. Don't do it. And Americans come there quite innocently and do it and don't know what they're doing. So there's all these cultural ideas. And when we start investigating all this, then the question is, do we adopt all of this? Does this mean that since Buddhism arose out of those cultures and in its paleontology and its fossilization of different customs of down through the ages and centuries, that if we don't like a particular thing, we just reject Buddhism entirely? Are we throwing away the baby for the bathwater then? Are there certain things that are maybe something we give or take in Buddhism and things which, or do we have to take the whole thing as a whole? I think to some degree Americans have, or most people have picked and chosen the aspects of Buddhism that had most value for them, and those which don't fall away. One of the aspects that's most important across borders in Buddhism is not bowing, but rather is the showing of respect. And that's common in all cultures. We show respect to each other. And there's various ways of showing respect. We greet people respectfully when they show up. We sometimes let people go through the door before us. If they're a guest in their house, we show respect and maybe offering them tea. There's various ways of showing respect. There's a notion in Buddhism that that if you want to receive the teachings, that you should show respect to the person giving the teachings, or give respect to the teachings. And partly it's because the person has to exert themselves. It's exhausting to teach. And so respecting what it takes for someone to put out. I think that there's something happens in the heart when you show respect to something, where I think you're more ready to accept, more ready to receive and reflect on the thing that you're teaching. If you're listening to teaching in a disrespectful way, I don't think you're really going to take in some deep place in your heart what's being said, so you can reflect on it in a deep way and really kind of address it. So bowing is one of those ways of showing respect in some cultures. So that's one thing that bowing can mean, this gesture. Another thing it can mean is that, as we said, is that the person you're bowing to, the thing you're bowing to, is of higher status than you. You're clearly showing that you're lower status and you're elevating this thing, kind of a subservience. You're a servant of this whatever. Another is simply an acknowledgement. acknowledgement of the person's greeting you. It's kind of a greeting. You know, I see you, hello, nice to see you. Another thing is the expression of gratitude. You know, kind of thank you. Beautiful expression, you know, thank you very much. Sometimes it's a kind of honoring, a little bit more deeply than, maybe it's connected to respect, but kind of a deep honor, kind of an expression of reverence for that which you're bowing to. So reverence, what does reverence mean? What is a sense of awe, perhaps, a sense of what you're bowing to is sacred, is quite beautiful, too. Important, awe-inspiring. I know people who bow sometimes to great mountains. They see these huge, awesome mountains. Wow! And bowing is a word of the body, of the word of gesture. It's a kind of part of the human vocabulary. And in different cultures, in different settings, the word means different things. Do we reject it, bowing, or do we appropriate it for our own expressions? And I think it would be poor as people if we simply rejected bowing because we don't like some of the meanings in different cultures, in different settings. But if we have something we want to express that has integrity to us, one of the avenues to do that is to bow. One of the reasons I bow at the end of, put my hands like this and make a small bow at the end of meditation, is at the end of my meditation, I often have a feeling of something like gratitude and deep appreciation that I just want to give expression to. And when certain things aren't given expression to, they're somehow, it doesn't feel right. It feels like they're stultified or something. And so sometimes giving expression to something gives kind of liberates it or frees it or makes it flow through us in a way that feels very good. And so I feel a sense of gratitude and appreciation at the end of a sitting. But the interesting issue is that, which may be a little bit bizarre, is if I ask myself, what am I grateful for, appreciative for, I'd actually rather not answer the question. It's just feelings of gratitude. I can have feelings of gratitude without having an object of gratitude. Is that possible? So just, just to give expression to that feeling. So Buddhist monastics, in the Theravadan world, that's one of the things that stimulated the question is when Jim Podolsky asked me, when Theravadan monks come to our center and we bow to them, they never bow back. Why is that? Well, they have a rule. They're not allowed to. They're not allowed to pay homage to, it goes through the list, to a monk who is lower than them in status, in seniority, who's been ordained less than them, shorter period of time. They're not allowed to pay homage, which includes bowing, to a layperson and to a woman. So women also are laywomen, but this also then implies nuns. They're not allowed to bow to a nun. And they're not allowed to bow to eunuchs. And they're not allowed to bow to various kinds of monks who might be more senior to them, but who maybe are on probation. Or need to be in probation. And there's a list of 10 different things. And why is that? So I've asked one monk this week, you know, why is it that monastics don't bow? And his answer was to lay people, for example. And he said that the first answer was, monastics are outside of those social games. They're kind of living outside of society, and they're not living in society's rules. So you can imagine in ancient India, where the rules are very strict about bowing to each other and status and all that, they're stepping outside of the status game in ancient India. And maybe that's why the Buddha didn't bow to anybody, because he was stepping outside of the status game. He wasn't playing by those rules. People would bow to him. And we have stories in the suttas, people coming to see the Buddha, and some people would just say hello and sit down and talk with him. Some people would, you know, do a kind of respectful bow, and some people would get down on their knees and bow. But the Buddha never gave any instructions that you should do this. It was just part of the Indian customs. People would do that, felt inspired. Or it was their custom or whatever, and they would relate to a spiritual teacher that way. But there's never any instructions for lay people that they're supposed to bow, or they have to bow. If they want teachings from a monastic, the monastic is not allowed to give teachings unless they feel the person who's asking for teaching has some modicum of respect. So bowing is one way to show that, but there's other ways of showing that too. You don't have to bow. But there has to be some, their rule is that there has to be some show of respect. Otherwise, they're not going to do it. To me, it feels a little bit harsh. Feels harsh to me that a monastic is not supposed to bow back to a lay person. It seems kind of odd to me that that's the case. So this person then said, the first answer was, this monk was, they're outside of those games. They're not going to participate in that. The second he said was that a monk will only bow to that which is trustworthy. And a lay person who has no practice or realization is not trustworthy. It's not a place to put your trust. But that seemed kind of odd to me too. Because there are some really wonderful lay people. Some are here in this room. And also there are different qualities in individual people. So you know, qualities are very trustworthy in everyone, and qualities which, you know, I'd be a little bit careful around. But you know, people are mixed bags, most of us, right? So you know, we bow maybe to the good qualities in the person. And we appreciate and bring out those aspects of a person by bowing to it. And I've noticed that a very interesting phenomena that if I'm in conflict with someone, I sometimes find it hard to shake their hands unless we're kind of agreeing to disagree or something, kind of like a agreement. But I'm always able to bow to people I'm in conflict with or angry with. Bowing expresses something different. It's like it's bypassing or looking more deeply than that area where the conflict exists. It's seeing the person as a person separate from the issue of disagreement. And one of the emails that went around that I read is that a person who grew up in Thailand said she very much valued a culture where people always bow to each other, because it's always, you always know that you're going to receive some expression of respect from everyone else. It's kind of like a bottom line of respect that everyone has among each other. And here in America, she feels, coming here, it's a little bit hard to feel that always, because people aren't always ready to bow to you in some way or other. So monastics don't bow to each other. Don't bow to lay people. Don't bow to the monks who have lower in seniority. But I grew up in a Buddhist culture, a Buddhist growing up, where we bowed to each other all the time. And in fact, in the San Francisco Zen Center, part of the teaching there, and you read this in Suzuki Roshi's book, Zen My Beginner's Mind, there's a chapter on bowing. A beautiful chapter, I believe, for me. And he says that a teacher should always be ready to bow to a student. And a student should always be ready to bow to the teacher. A wife should always be ready to bow to a husband. A husband should always be ready to bow to a wife. We should always be ready to bow to each other. He says something like, a teacher who's not ready to bow to a student is not really able to bow to the Buddha, or shouldn't be a teacher or something. So at San Francisco Zen Center, we all bowed to each other. There wasn't a feeling that some people shouldn't be bowed to because they were, you know, you shouldn't bow back to someone if they bowed to you. And in fact, sometimes the student is supposed to bow to the teacher. I mean, the teacher is supposed to bow to the student. So I grew up in a situation, a culture, where bowing was kind of something we did to each other equally. It wasn't an expression of inequality in the bowing. It was an expression of I would almost say equality. So the American idea that bowing you shouldn't do bowing because it's an expression of inequality. I grew up in a Buddhist culture where I didn't feel that, but I felt it was actually an expression of very deep equality, kind of very deep honoring and respecting of the other person. So in Hinduism, when they put their hands together like this and bow, they sometimes say namaste. And sometimes that's translated to, I'm bowing to the, or paying homage to that which is divine inside of you, the God within you or something. And that's a little bit problematic for Buddhists to say, you know, the divine or the God within you. But the idea that we're bowing to something, each person has something very profound in their humanity, in their hearts, in their minds, and just being a human being that's worthy of bowing to. And something is lost if we just simply shake hands with them or say, hi, howdy. That something, you know, something expressed, some deep equality, some deep connection, respect, reverence of another human being, just for being a human being, some deep sense of appreciation, of gratitude, gratitude for this world we live in, gratitude for the society of people who we share with. So I grew up in a Buddhist culture where that was kind of the vocab, that was the word, the meaning assigned to this gesture. So I'm very comfortable. I love to bow. In fact, that it would be very odd for me if I lost this form of expression. This, you know, I'd feel much poorer if I didn't have this to express. It does something physiologically to me to put my hands together in front of my heart, to bring my hands together and bow. There's a kind of softening energetically. There's kind of a change that goes on. Suzuki Roshi, in his chapter on bowing, does acknowledge the bow there. Does acknowledge the bowing traditionally has some meaning of, you know, you're bowing to someone who's has more, you know, worthy of bowing to. But the most important point he makes there is that bowing is an expression of giving up our self-centered ideas. And here is one way of looking at bowing, another part of the vocabulary of bowing. The bowing is an antidote to, certainly to arrogance, but to self-centered ideas, to being too self-obsessed. But being self-obsessed doesn't only have to be being arrogant. A lot of people are self-obsessed and they're the opposite. They feel like they're, you know, unworthy. But to have this gesture, which is a kind of lowering oneself, kind of giving oneself up to something, is a kind of giving up of self-centered ideas, giving up our own attempts to manipulate and control things. So when I was a monk at Tassajara, my little motto was, when in doubt, bow. And part of the reason for the motto was, or the reason for it was, we bowed so much, there's so much ceremony and activities, that if you didn't know in a ceremony what to do, you probably wouldn't go wrong if you took that opportunity to bow. But I've come to learn that this is a very nice motto anyway. When in doubt, bow. When you don't know what to do in life, bow. Bow to the uncertainty of it. Bow to your difficulty. When situations are hopeless, then bow. And part of the idea of bowing to things, to situations, activities, is that situations can be your teacher. If what's happening to you is you're caught up in self, arrogance, self-centeredness, egotism, and the idea of I'm in control, I can do this, I can manage myself. When you can't manage yourself or can't control the situation, great, you bow. So one example of this now as I'm beginning to get older, I didn't have a good way here, right, so I can say this, is my body doesn't work in all the ways that I'm used to from when I was younger. My body's beginning to break down. My eyesight is getting worse and worse, and all kinds of things are not working so well. And my stamina is not so good, and when I go exercise now, I used to be able to just kind of throw myself into exercise pretty much and just do whatever I wanted to do. And now I need to pace myself because my body isn't just kind of up for it. You know, the recovery period is longer. So now I have to learn how to pace myself. I learned that I can't exercise as much as I want to exercise because it just doesn't work the next days. And not just because it isn't simply because I ache, but because just somehow it takes longer to recover. So I have to exercise like, you know, less so I can do it every day. So, you know, my body, my health and all this stuff. What am I supposed to do about that? You know, it's kind of a letting go. Oh, this too I have to bow to. This too I have to let go of. This too, my self-centered ideas and what I can do and accomplish. It's a kind of a grace in bowing. Oh, okay, this too I let go of. This too I accept. This too is my teacher. Because if you don't take aging as your teacher, I think the alternative is not so pretty. Your teacher about what to let go of, what your kind of self-centered ideas of how things should be, your ideals, what you think you need to survive and like get along in life and be happy. So the Theravada monastics have certain attitudes towards bowing. Theravada lay people, there's no teachings about how they're supposed to do about bowing. I can look through the suttas, look through the Abhidharma, look through the Vinaya, look through all the There's no teachings about what you're supposed to do, what we're supposed to do as lay people. You know what that means? We can do whatever we want. And I would encourage each of you to reflect on this topic of bowing. Think about when in our society we bow and why do we bow. There are times in our society, American society, we bow, mostly on stage. But why on stage do we people bow? If you were on stage and someone's applauding you, would you bow? Why? Why would you do that in that situation? Are there ways in which you could use bowing, incorporate it, that has maybe some very deep meaning for you? Not only deep meaning as a human being, engaging with other human beings and other activities, but maybe deep meaning for spiritual practice, the kind of purification, the kind of refinement of character, the kind of letting go, the kind of self-reflection and self-knowledge, self-understanding that comes with spiritual practice. Does bowing offer benefit for that? Food and fuel for spiritual practice? The area of self-understanding, self-knowledge? I think it's a wonderful area to explore. And if you're uncomfortable with bowing, I would suggest bow and explore it. Bow so you can understand what's going on there. Maybe there's very good reasons why you're uncomfortable with bowing, and I bow to those reasons. And maybe there's something else going on there that's valuable to look at, you know. Maybe a certain kind of unhealthy self-centeredness. When Suzuki Roshi came to America, he changed the morning ritual, the chant in the morning in Zen monasteries. And before the chanting and after the chanting, just like in Theravadin monasteries, you do three bows, beginning and the end of that period of chanting in the morning service. Suzuki Roshi looked around America, his students, and realized the difficulty they had with bowing, and realized in his wisdom that Americans needed to bow more. So he instituted 9 bows. They don't do 9 bows in Japan. They only do it in America because the Suzuki Roshi felt that Americans needed to bow to help them with their self-centered ideas. So what is it to bow? What is it to bow to another being, human being, out of respect? Is it possible to bow out of equality, to equals, to bow to some the good qualities in the other person, or maybe more profoundly, the light in each person, or the potential of Buddhahood in each person, freedom? To the place where we are one, bowing to the place where we are one. Some people say when you put your hands together, flat together, you're overcoming the duality of self and other. Zen Master Dogen said, Buddhism will survive for a long time if people bow. In the modern world, this has been translated kind of colloquial language. If there's no bowing, there's no Buddhism. I wouldn't go that far to say that. I think Buddhism will survive without bowing, but it'll be a lot harder without that expression of respect and reverence and gratitude and all that comes with that gesture. So that's probably enough. I probably exhausted the topic enough for now. I mostly wanted to stimulate your thoughts and ideas around it, you all to reflect on it, and to challenge you a little bit to think about the topic more deeply. If you never bowed much in your life at all, you might experiment with it, trying it on. So there's about 3 minutes left here, and not very much time for questions, protests. Yes?
It seems like such a natural translation of the Namaste tradition to bow to the Buddha nature of the other. And I just wondered, apparently you would have mentioned it if any particular tradition had ever picked that up, had never made that translation.
Yeah, it could well be. I've never known anybody say you're bowing to the Buddha nature in someone else. But I could imagine saying that. I can imagine modern teachers saying that. Theravada monastics would not say it because in Theravada Buddhism they don't believe in Buddha nature. Exactly. And then you have to ask, what is Buddha nature? But you know, that's a Mahayana idea. So, but American Buddhists, also Vipassana Buddhists, are, you know, adopting a lot of different things from Mahayana, including using the word Buddha nature. And that's a whole topic for another day if you want to hear about Buddha nature. Steve?
At the Zetsun of Los Angeles, we were taught you would bow into your Buddha nature. But I felt like you were in the Zendo, and it really, it felt so natural to bow. I remember one time seeing Mizumi Roshi get down on his hands and knees and bow to one of his senior students, senior monks. Well, the monk bowed to him. And it just felt like such an expression of being human. But the second thing, those of you who feel awkward about handshakes and how it doesn't express stuff, you have to know the origin of the handshake. The handshake started in the medieval times. And when kings used to meet each other, they used to usually take out their daggers and lop off their heads. And so they get control of the kingdom. So what you did in the handshake is you were showing that you didn't have a weapon in your hand. So it was a way of showing you were disarmed. And so people came and shook. And if you're interested to know the origin of the toast, when people toasted each other, the glasses came together and liquids would intermix, which means if you're trying to poison the other guy, you wouldn't do that because you allow your liquids to interchange, and then you have a toast to drink and you can trust the other person. So they all have the origins of showing trust when you're not harming, which is a lot lower status than bowing.
Part of bowing is an expression of humility. And at the Zen Center, I remember, whenever someone's going to give a Dharma talk, they'd always do three bows to the Buddha before they give the talk. And it felt quite appropriate to me to do that because, it's kind of like an expression of humility that with all of your, shortcomings and partial understanding and partial practice realization, you were still going to try to best of your ability, express the Dharma, which maybe you weren't completely 100% qualified to express, but you're going to, at least show that humility, show that, to the Buddha at least, that you kind of do your best. And some people, when they bow to the Buddha before a Dharma talk, are kind of asking the Buddha or asking the Buddha Dharma Sangha for, for help. Yes, Bonnie?
Just three very quick little vignettes. When I was in Japan last month, I was very struck by no one did use their hands. And that there's this kind of unconscious mirroring that happens when we're in a culture that bows in a certain kind of way. So the first time I went like this and saw no one else did, there was just a very comfortable way of acknowledging the respect with the bowing. And it's interesting to hear from you that there's different degrees. I thought it had to do with either introversion, extroversion, how far people went, or body posture, size of people, but it was all quite different. And their hands are very close to their body. Second, just a personal reaction that I have sometimes when I'm really, in a battle, and it's usually only with my kids, sometimes I will stop myself by just bowing, and it just dissipates everything. My kids kind of stop, and they don't and the third may seem kind of strange, but your story, the way you kind of acquiesce with that man in your life, my dog will do this in deference or respect. So I believe in listening to this conversation, there's an interspecies reaction. And he's very selective, but when he meets a new dog, he will often go all the way down. And he just waits. It's a greeting, it's a respect. And then he doesn't wait for the dog to come to him, but something happens. He goes down, it sends off a certain communication. The other dog will go down, and then they will meet somewhere else. If there's something about it related to this.
About 10 years ago, Ajahn Amaro came to visit a retreat that I was teaching at Santa Sabina, the old students' retreat. And he was just visiting for the day, just kind of saying hello to the teachers there and just hanging out for a few hours. But we asked him to give a Dharma talk that afternoon. So he gave a beautiful Dharma talk on loving kindness. And it was one of the most inspired Dharma talks I ever heard. It was just quite beautiful. And so at the end of the Dharma talk, he got up to leave, which teachers usually do, but that's nothing. I get up to leave from here, right? When I leave, you couldn't care less, right? You're all gone by the time I get up, usually. But he got up to leave. And as he was getting up, everyone in the hall stood up with him. There was no one had said, this is what you should do. There was no, you know, we don't have any custom of doing that. Everyone stood and put their hands together, which I guess people are somewhat familiar with doing, and stood and faced him and faced him as he's walking out the room out of respect. And because people had been so moved by that talk. And later people were saying, boy, I sounded like I was listening to the Buddha. You know, just it was so amazing, this talk. And I was just struck by the spontaneity of this deep inner move within people, without even thinking about it, I felt, to get up and just offer him this kind of respect for what he had just done. So there's something very, very profound kind of built into our system, perhaps, this thing.
I appreciate that in addition to your conceptual discussion of bowing, which I found very useful, that you talked about the physiological part. And I just wanted to add about the prostration, because I think that ended on the note of that it always represents the sort of feet thing and lifting that. That I do that in my practice, full prostration. And it's also, all of these things I think are very connected physically. And it's also true that when you sit a sesshin, where you sit and you sit and you sit, and then maybe do a little slow walking, which is what they do in the Zen practice, that it's very good for your body to lie down, stretch out, lift your arms a little, and doing that 9 times is fine for me, because it really helps, and all of that's very connected.
Some teachers have given instructions to students to do a lot of bowing, like 108 bows every day. Because it's really not for the exercise so much, but because it's so necessary for some. You know, the mind is so stubborn. Have you noticed that? And it's so hard to get in there and kind of sometimes and do something with it, and sometimes it takes a lot of bowing. In Suzuki Roshi's chapter on bowing, he talks about his teacher had a callus on his forehead from all this bowing. And he said, I had to bow so much because I have such a stubborn nature. Yes.
I've never thought about this until now in your talk, but at the monastery at Yukaya, which I go to a lot, in chanting and in the normal practice and sitting in the Dhamma talks, bows are always done in three, and it has never actually been explained, but. At least to the lay people, so far as I know, but one incorporates as one goes along the realization that this is about the triple gem. And in doing the vows always in three, you never lose sight of the connectedness between each of those elements. And I think bowing then becomes, in any single gesture, always those three.
So it's very common to hear that when you're bowing three times, you're bowing to Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. And so when you bow to a Buddhist monastic sometimes, you're not bowing to the individual person, but you're bowing to what the robes represent. The robes represent the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. And so it doesn't really matter if the person's not, it's a problematic person in robes, but you're bowing to what it symbolizes. And some people, when they bow, will not just only bow, but also will do an internal kind of cognitive thing. And sometimes people, as they bow, say, I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma. So they actually say it in their mind.
When Pat and I were in Sri Lanka, we had a chance to meet the head monk, the better of the two Buddhist groups there. And so when we met him, I prostrated 3 times. And he said something to one of his associates. And the translator later told me, he said, I wish some of our people would do
that. Yes?
Growing up in a tradition of no bowing, the only exposure I had to bowing was in the movies or stories or things like this. So I had no direct experience. And this only came 5 years ago when I started meditation practice in here. And I found that whenever I started bowing, that it was like a whole tension just released from my body, just like it just melted away. And then I read this chapter in Suzuki Roshi's book about the
about the sort of the releasing of the self, the tightening lessons when I do the bowing. And so I've just incorporated that in my daily practice all the time because it does reduce the tightness around the self and it does release this tension. This tension just melts.
So in that chapter, Suzuki Roshi says you should always be ready to bow. And doesn't mean you have to bow, but that state of mind or state of heart that's always ready to bow, what is that like? What would you like to go through life always ready to bow? Yeah.